Hello and welcome to the latest edition of Women's Soccer Zone. Lovely to have you with us once again, and not for the first time. I'm joined by my friend out in the United States, JJ Duke from Our Game magazine. JJ, how you doing, pal?
Oh, hopefully it's not the last time that you have me, but yeah, it's good to be here.
Not the first and not the last, without a doubt. Well, plenty to get through on this one, mate. We're going to have a look at an exciting finale that is due to occur this coming weekend in the FAWSL. It's going to be a two-horse race between Manchester City and Chelsea Ladies as they fight for the league title. We're going to have a quick look at what's going on in Germany. In France, there was a clash between the two giants in French football, Lyon and PSG, but wasn't as close as many would have expected it to be. We're going to have a little chat about what's going on down in Australia, because some of the teams are starting to announce their squads for the upcoming W League. There's been a managerial departure and arrival in the NWSL, so we're going to have a quick chat about that. And I mentioned Australia. It was announced in the last couple of weeks that a real ambassador for Australian football, Melissa Barbieri, has announced her retirement from international football. So I managed to catch up with her to have a chat about her career and look back over some of her highlights. So without further ado, let's get cracking.
Women's Soccer Zone. Follow the show on Twitter at WOSOZone.
So we kick off, first of all, with the FAWSL. And JJ, we are in for an exciting finale once again. For the third season running, it's going down to the final day of the season. Chelsea Ladies and Manchester City Women, it's going to be a big one.
Yeah, you know, it's appreciated when you're looking over season, you're seeing the WSL year after year after year. It seems that the last day is really the day that's the most entertaining to watch. What was it? Last year, we had three teams that were fighting for it, and it came down to literally the final seconds of to determine who had a who won the championship.
Yep, it was between Chelsea, Liverpool, and Birmingham. Liverpool, huge outsiders last year, and managed to creep in at the final hurdle and take a back-to-back titles. But Liverpool, we'll talk about them in a second, because they have fallen away massively this year. But it is Chelsea Ladies who have it in their hands. Convincing win over the weekend away at Liverpool. Really formidable front line, I tell you, mate. Enioluco, Frank Kirby, Jisoo Yoon, Gemma Davison. They absolutely tore Liverpool apart. And it's going to be, I think, probably going to them. They've got Sunderland Women at home. I should say Sunderland Ladies. Sunderland, brilliant season for them, have cemented fourth position. They can't move up and they can't move down on the final weekend. A lot of people's favourites for relegation, having come up from FAWSL 2. Real credit to that squad. But I think it's probably going to be a little bit of a far stretch for them to try and get anything at Chelsea. Manchester City Women, they've got Notts County Ladies. Not an easy one. I would expect them to win, because Notts County, since the FA Cup final, have hit some really poor form, and I don't really know why that is, because there's some quality in that side and they've not had a good run of results, and I would expect Man City to win. But if Chelsea win, doesn't matter, they will win the title.
Yeah, you know, going back to your point about Notts County, it's sometimes that dream match, that final for a cup, and if you don't have the right result, things can spiral down quickly. Notts knew at that point that they weren't really going to be contending for a title, so you're playing for that one cup. They didn't get it, and then all of a sudden reality hits. And you know, again, you never want to talk about the negativity, but at the same time, Notts hasn't played well enough. As you said, Sunderland already locked up fourth. They know they can't do any better nor worse, but I think for them, this should be a fun match for them to go up against Chelsea. Hey, why not be the spoiled sports once again? As you said, no one predicted them to have any sort of success that they had. But as you said, credit to them. They got out of the gate really well, and they put themselves into a position that they could coast in the second half of the season, knowing that they could do the job. And if they were to win, and you know, Manchester City all out of nowhere hosting Notts on the last day, sneaking up and winning, that'd be fun to watch.
Yeah, and I think you've got to remember as well that Sunderland did lead the table at one point, and they inflicted Chelsea's biggest defeat of the season, 4-0 up in Sunderland. And I think, you know, they on the day, they absolutely ran riot over Chelsea. But I think that combined with the feeling that Chelsea went through and the heartache that they went through last year after losing it on the final day, I can't see past them, mate. I really, really can't. They are solid from back to front. Hedvig Lindau has been a real rocking goal for them. Their back four is really settled. Drew Spence and Katie Chapman have been solid in midfield. And as I said, that front four, Kirby, Aluko, Davison and Ji So-yoon, they will give anyone a match anywhere in Europe. And I think for that reason, it's probably going to go to Chelsea ladies. Manchester City women, though, hats off to them. They're not out of it by any means. But they've, you know, if result goes their way, they will be competing in next season's Champions League for the first time. Arsenal will try and have something to say about that. They finished the season at home to Birmingham City Ladies, I think it is, off the top of my head. Mm-hmm. They will be looking to try and sneak into that Champions League position, but they need a miracle, to be honest with you. They need City to lose, and they need a 7-goal swing to ensure they get that second place. But another exciting season, mate, and I think we look at the players that are coming over to England and the players that continue to be linked to come over to England, and you have to give the FA a pat on the back, because the FAWSL has done exactly what it says on the tin. They wanted a more competitive league. They've got a more competitive league.
And I think it also helps that, you know, you have that second Champions League spot. You had the success last year with Bristol Academy getting fairly deep into the knockout rounds. And, you know, as you said, credit to them. They're getting players to come in. They're buying into what the league is offering. You can compete for more than one competition per year, where you have the Continental Cup. You obviously have the FA Cup every year as well. So you're playing for more than just one thing, which, you know, I think still, speaking from an American perspective, you don't have that. So that's why players are looking, hey, you know, if we can't win it here, let's go after the cup.
Yeah, and we've talked a lot about the league title. We have to talk about the other end of the table as well. Unfortunately, it was confirmed last weekend that Bristol Academy have been relegated. They will play their football in FAWSL 2. A real shame, mate. You know, I went and met the guys behind Bristol Academy probably 2 or 3 years ago, when I was starting out with Women's Football Podcast before Women's Soccer Zone. And really great people, really community focused. They've got a great setup there. They just really, really felt They felt the pinch, and they felt the impact of losing so many players in one go. The likes of Tash Harding, who's gone on to do really well at Man City Women, Siobhan Chamberlain, an England international, Corinne Yorston, who was the club captain. You know, to lose all those players and lose that experience. And then obviously Dave Edmondson, didn't quite work out for him. And actually, it was interesting, Casey Stoney was on the women's football show over here on the BBC, and Casey openly said, you know, that I don't think the players really warmed to Dave Edmondson, and it was always going to be very difficult for him following in the footsteps of Mark Sampson, who we know did a great job at Bristol, took them to runners-up in the league, got them into the Champions League. It was always going to be a difficult job for him and for Willie Kirk, who came in to replace him. But I really hope Bristol can bounce back, because it's a fantastic club, really well supported, and they do things the right way. They don't have a huge budget, and I think that's one of the things that's really worked against them. They don't have the money that other clubs have, and it's been seen by one win all season. But it's a real, real shame. And they'll be replaced by Doncaster Rovers Belles and Reading Women, who both were confirmed as promoted teams this season. This weekend gone. Still the league title to be decided, but Doncaster and Reading promoted, so congratulations to them.
Oh, absolutely well deserved. That's a long season for them with playing, unlike currently the WSL1 format, where there's 8 teams, you play just a natural home and home for 14 matches. You're playing an 18 match schedule plus the Continental Cup and the FA Cup. That's a pretty long grinding season. Doncaster only allowing 15 goals this year. Reading, of course, they were buoyed by the fact that Fran Kirby started the year with them and scored all those goals, and now they're reaping the rewards like Doncaster and getting up. But, you know, as you pointed out, how are they going to fare in the top level? There's a lot of teams that are spending a lot of money now. You know, you have obviously the likes of Manchester City and Chelsea that are going out and, you know, splashing for big players. How are they going to compete next year against the top level?
it was questions that people were asking of Sunderland, and you have to look at how they've done. So it will be interesting. I think Doncaster will be better equipped when they come up. They had a hard time when they were in the WSL one first time round. Reading Women have some really exciting young players in their team. They've got some experience in there as well with Welsh internationals like Kylie Davis and Helen Ward. So it'll be interesting to see how they fare. Now, I've deliberately left Liverpool Ladies to the end. We mentioned that they obviously had back-to-back titles the last year and the year before. Fallen away hugely this year, and I think that's probably partly down to the fact that teams around them really kind of had to follow in their footsteps. It was 2 years ago that Liverpool were investing heavily. Matt Beard came in. He completely changed them, not just a few players. He overhauled the whole squad, essentially. He brought in the players that he wanted. He was able to take them to back-to-back titles, but everyone else has kind of recognised that. They've invested in their side. And Liverpool, depending on how results go this weekend, mate, they could finish the season second bottom. And for considering they've won back-to-back titles, that is quite a big drop-off.
Yeah, they could. And, you know, again, and then you look at the other perspective, they could finish fifth. But I think still it will be going down as 2015 is a disappointment for them, to be fair. You know, it's, you can't do any better, obviously, in the league than being the champions, of course, you know, if you win a couple extra titles with the Cups. But it never really got going. You know, 8 losses, a -7 goal difference, and they've scored just averaging 1 goal per match. You know, they saw a decent-sized turnover in their roster as well. And, you know, as you alluded to, everybody caught up. So it's now going to be interesting to see how they go about 2016. Fortunately for them, they know they will be back in WSL 1. But, you know, how are they going to adapt to new surroundings?
Yeah, and they have been unlucky. I'm not going to sit here criticising them. It's very easy from a media perspective to sit here and point the finger. But they have been unfortunate. Asisat Oshoala has only just come back from injury. Farrah Williams has missed a lot of the second part of the season after the World Cup. As we already alluded to, they've lost players, the likes of Gemma Davison, Nicole Rolser, that they weren't able to necessarily replace with the same quality. And as a result of that, as we've said, you know, teams have overtaken them, and they are going to have to look at how they're going to be able to catch back up with those teams that have overtaken them, because the rumour is that maybe the men's side, the men's division of the club, who have been very supportive, are losing maybe a little bit of interest. I can't confirm that, but it's only whispers that I've heard, and I hope that's not true, because Liverpool Ladies have been, you know, they've been a real pleasure to watch in certain parts of the WSL since those players came in, and since they took it, since they got that support from the men's team. But we deliberately left them last as well, because they will have to search for a new manager for next year. And I guess it will move us nicely onto the NWSL very briefly, because Matt Beard will be leaving Liverpool Ladies and moving over to Boston to take over at the Breakers.
Yeah, that it was a move that really caught a few people by surprise. But listening in on the conference that he talked with, he said that it was the right time for him to look for a move. You know, now taking this just from a neutral perspective, you're thinking now, as we've talked about, Liverpool, you know, had their 2 years where they won the title, they've got the Champions League. Now all the players that he brought in have been moving on to bigger and better pastures, if you will, and maybe he's thinking he's done all that he can for Liverpool, and, you know, maybe trying his luck overseas. But he's going to be taking over a Boston team. You know, they do a lot of good things in that organization, right? But the one thing that has eluded them has been getting results on the field. I mean, even look back to teams that they've had in years past, whether it be in WPS or the NWSL, they should be a playoff contender, you know, outside of maybe this year. You know, they have had rosters on paper that are very strong, and, you know, they haven't found that final piece to the puzzle. Will Matt Beard be it? Not sure, but it's going to change things up.
Well, he's going to have to learn very quickly, isn't he? Because with the team finishing bottom, there's a lot of work to do there, and there's a bit of a British connection there. Obviously, Lee Billiard is the general manager, who is also British, and I think he said, didn't he, that in the conference call, unfortunately, I didn't get an opportunity to listen in, but Matt Beard was someone that they were quite keen to get in because of the success that he's had at Liverpool Ladies. And I think Matt even said himself, you know, I feel like I've taken Liverpool as far as I can, and it was too good an opportunity and too good a challenge to turn down. But like Laura Harvey, like Mark Parsons, and like lesser extent Paul Riley, who'd already worked in the States before, Matt Beer is going to have to learn very quickly the trade system, the draft system, because Boston have issues probably more than any other team that need to be addressed. And if he wants to be successful and get that team into the playoffs, and that was what Lee Billy had said, you know, the expectation is to get into the playoffs, he's going to have to learn very quickly.
No, that he is. And I mean, you know, he will have help at least to get through the early stages. Boston, as far as we know right now, will have the number one overall pick in the college draft next year. So, you know, they'll have resources. He said, Matt Beer in the conference, that, you know, no roster decisions or anything's going to be made until he's had fair time to evaluate the talent and what he's currently working with. Obviously, you know, he knows right now that Christy Mewis is currently playing with Bayern, so hopefully that little stint overseas will help her game evolve a bit. But yeah, there's going to be some changes that are going to come up north, and not sure what's it going to be and what the team's going to look like next April. But, you know, I'm looking forward to see what he does with that team, because again, Boston does a lot of things right in terms of an organization. They just have yet to have that translate over to success in the field.
Well, we wish Matt well. I think it's nice to see another British coach going over to the US, and for a matter of hours there were four British coaches managing in the NWSL with Mark Parsons and Laura Harvey and Paul Riley, who unfortunately has not been required to extend his contract, or has not been offered the opportunity to extend his contract at the Portland Thorns, and now finds himself out of a job after what can only be described as a disappointing season. But I think, you know, we'd agree that there was probably some underlying issues there that go beyond Paul Riley, but it wasn't a surprise when that news was announced, was it?
No, it wasn't. I mean, you know, we can only answer questions that we see on the field. Paul Riley said at the draft this year, shortly after, that he was very well knowing of the expectation that he had this year. He had a lot of players that were internationals going to be representing the World Cup. He thought that he was going to be fine with the resources that he had and who he was going to bring in, but it was a very disappointing season for Portland fans. They draw the best, they market the best, they expect the best, and they did not get that. Now, granted, were there a lot of injuries? Yes. Were there, you know, personnel changes midway through the year? Yes. But with that being said, you know, it's going to be tough to see who Mayor Paulson is going to bring in to replace Paul Riley, because like Matt Beard, this new manager is going to have a lot of issues and a lot of challenges to work out in a short period of time.
Well, the name that keeps cropping up is Tom Samani.
Yep, that it is. And that's an interesting move, because, you know, it's been a long time since Tom Samani has been with a club team, always national teams. But, you know, then again, he does bring an interesting style of soccer to be played, and, you know, I have a feeling that he will warm to Portland, but then again, we don't know what's going to be happening over there.
No, absolutely, and I think it's a shame. I interviewed Paul Riley when he joined the club, and he had really good ideas, and obviously he has a very good background. He was very successful with the Philadelphia Independents when he was when he was coach back in the WPS, and I don't think it's the last we've seen of Paul Riley. It wouldn't surprise me if he picks up a job quite easily elsewhere. I think he's highly respected, very well thought of, and unfortunately it just didn't work out for him in Portland. But as I said, one English manager in, one English manager out. We're not going to go too much into the NWSL. Just for information, for anyone that missed it, JJ and I did record an NWSL Championship game preview at the end of last week. We had interviews with Bev Yanez of the Seattle Reign and Becca Morrows of FC Kansas City. So if you do want to have a listen to that, it's on iTunes and it's on audioboom.com/WOSOZone. So have a listen out for that. And I think JJ will have a quick break, and when we come back, we will have a little chat about what's going on in Europe.
Women's Soccer Zone would like to thank our partners, She Kicks Magazine. Subscribe at shekicks.net for even more women's football.
So welcome back, JJ. I think the best place to start off in Europe is France. And this past weekend, it was the clash of the titans, Olympique Lyonnais, current French champions, against last season's UEFA Women's Champions League finalist PSG. On paper, two of the strongest teams in Europe. On paper, you'd expect it to be close. In reality, it really wasn't.
Yeah, that it was. We talked before the show, you and I, Kieran, and you said that it was Lyon destroying PSG. Wait, check that. Ada Hegerberg, or one woman wrecking crew, against PSG. And with a hat trick, you know, this kind of confirmed what some of us already kind of knew, but didn't really want to say fully, that Lyon still remains the top to beat, and it's going to be very hard to see anybody taking points off this team just by looking at the lineup that they turn out.
Yeah, and we spoke, as you say, before recording, Ada Hegerberg in her second season with Lyon. I've got no doubt in my mind that within the next couple of years she will be a contender or even a finalist for best player in Europe, and give it a few more years, I wouldn't be surprised if she's in Switzerland, in Geneva, on that stage as a contender for the Ballon d'Or, because she, at the age that she is and the players that she's surrounded by, it's scary how good she is going to get. But I think one thing we have to mention going away from Lyon is PSG came into the season having had UEFA Women's Champions League final spot last year, once again fell a little bit short when trying to compete with Lyon. It's not a great sign, is it, when you invest like they have? They've brought in players like Anya Mittag, they've brought in Christiane, they've brought in a number of players to try and boost that squad. And again, they are still falling substantially short.
Yeah, they are. I mean, granted, on a given day, you never know what happens. You know, PSG is a club that, similar to Lyon, they're built to play in Champions League. It's almost a guaranteed certainty that they're going to finish 1-2 in the French League every year. Obviously, right now, four matches in, PSG is currently sitting in fifth position, but that will quickly change once things take shape. But yeah, no, it's hard to play, and we've had this conversation before, to psych yourself up in the league to play just two matches that really have any sort of major standing. You know, no disrespect to the other clubs that play in the French league, but you know, when you know that, okay, you have to beat Lyon twice and make sure that you don't drop many, if any, points to any of the other teams, and you have the league sewn up, it's kind of hard to do, because you have to turn the switch on, and some days the switch is going to be working full throttle and some days it's not. And for PSG this past weekend, it was ugly.
Well, you mentioned about getting yourself motivated for two games in the season. Should we talk about motivation for big clubs in Germany and the Pokal Cup, which is of the German competitions that isn't the league? Some big scorelines. I'm not going to read them all out, but FFC Frankfurt won 14-0. Wolfsburg won 19-0. Tabina Potsdam won 11-0. How do you get yourself motivated for games in a competition against regional amateur sides when you know that you're going to go there and you're going to stick double figures past the team?
Well, you know, I think it's a little bit of a different scenario for Germany, where in the league you have more than half of the teams in the Bundesliga who are going to be competitive, and then you're going to always have a surprise team or two. It's early rounds. There were, on the other end of the spectrum, some teams that had to dig down deep to grind a result. Bayern Munich, you don't want to say they only won 3-0, but they won just by a scoreline of 3-0. You look at teams like USV Jena, who has been, you know, down in a few years, but still they're always a team that you have to respect. They only got by 2-1 away to Kloppenburg. FC Cologne won 4-1 to Borussia Mönchengladbach. Cologne have spent a decent amount of money over the past year to bring in some players. So it is tough. I mean, you're going to have those lopsided score lines. You and I have gone on before about, you know, we are still prone in Europe to have in these competitions some unpleasing score lines. But at the same time, you just have to go with it, I think, for some teams.
Well, fair play to Sanat Yakapfi for Wolfsburg, Hungary international. She came on at half-time in her game and managed to bag five in Wolfsburg's 19. So not a bad effort, but yeah, look, I'm sure in the later rounds of the competition it gets interesting, but when you see 19s and 11s and 14s, you just kind of think, is there really any point? And I know that sounds really awful, but I just don't know how the players can get motivated for that. And it's not exactly a confidence boost for the players that they're coming up against either, is it? So, interesting one that I just wanted to kind of cover. The league is very much going according to plan. You've got the usual suspects near the top of the league. Bayern Munich won the big clash against Wolfsburg a few weeks ago, which we won't go into because it was a little bit far back. But I think very quickly, it's worth mentioning that the UEFA Women's Champions League kicks off next week as well. Some interesting ties. Chelsea coming up against Glasgow City. Liverpool go to Brescia. And the earlier rounds, you don't necessarily see too many highly competitive games. Occasionally, we get the odd draw that might come up with two big sides coming up against each other. But we'll definitely discuss the UEFA Women's Champions League in more detail in the coming weeks. I guess what we probably should do, mate, is have a quick break, and then, as mentioned in our intro, gonna have a little look at what's going on in Australia, because the W League is coming upon us, and it's worth having a look at some of the squads that are being announced. So we will be back just after this.
Women's Soccer Zone. It's all about the players.
So welcome back, JJ. We go down under into Australia, and just for reference, people, we will be getting our friends at the women's game back to talk about the season when it kicks off. We had our friend Rachel Collier, who is an expat who is living in Perth, so we will no doubt get her back, and Anne O'Dong, who runs and oversees the women's game, will no doubt speak to her and get her views and some previews of what we can expect in the coming season. But JJ, some interesting players that are being announced. Squads are slowly being revealed. And a few Americans I'm sure you're interested in who are going to be in the league. Western Sydney Wanderers are one of those that have got some interesting faces that they've announced this week.
Yeah, we did find out a few of those internationals. We knew that Keelan Winters, who's the captain of the Seattle Reign, is heading back once again to play in Western Sydney. You also have the likes of Kendall Johnson, who did very well for Portland this year, despite their not the best records in the National Women's Soccer League, but she started again. She went down last year and is playing again. But I think the one that really is taking a lot of people by surprise is Canadian international Carmelina Moscato is going to be playing for the Wanderers this season. I can tell you that one kind of caught me very much off guard, that Carm is going to be playing down there, but good for her. I'm looking forward to see what she can do with the Wanderers this season, who didn't have a great go of it last year, but they're returning a lot of their squad, a lot of young but promising stars, a lot of players that play on the Australia Youth International team. So, definitely some mix, but they could be a team that can pick away a few points here and there and make themselves competitive.
Well, they'll need those experienced players, because Western Sydney were very inconsistent last year and they were on the end of some quite heavy score lines, and I know Keelan Winters was a real standout for them. But we'll get Carm on the show, I think, mate. We get on very well with Carm. I met her when I was out in Seattle last year, and I think it might be worth us getting her on and have a little chat about how it is that move down to Australia has come about, because she hasn't played any club football for quite some time, has she? She missed the whole of the NWSL season last year with injury in Seattle. She didn't have a club this year. So it'll be interesting to see how she fares down under. But we'll get her on the show. We'll have a chat with her and see if we can get her on in the next couple of weeks. But they're just one club. Rookie from Sky Blue FC, Sarah Killian, will be playing in Adelaide. That'll be a good experience for her.
Yeah, well, she's a very possession-oriented midfielder. Seen her play a few times with Sky Blue, does a lot of good things. I think this is a strong move for her in terms of continuing to get first-team matches. Adelaide, another team that's, not to say they've had a rough go of it the past couple seasons, but they've been sitting outside the playoffs. or I guess what the grand final, if you will, in the league semifinals. But, you know, again, another chance for Sarah to keep going and do what she does and hold on to the ball and possess. But, yeah, good move for her.
And moving away from the American players, I'm not going to go through all the teams. As I said, we'll get the women's game guys on because they have more of an insight than we do. And there's so much to cover off and we really don't have time to do on this show. What we'll probably do is we'll do a proper preview of the W League, much like we did at the start of the NWSL and the FAWSL. But I was interested to see the moves that Melbourne City have been making, mate, and managed to poach away some of Melbourne Victory's bigger assets in Bree Davey and captain Steph Catley. Now, we know the impact that Man City women have had. We know that Melbourne City FC are one of the sister clubs of Man City women. Added to Lisa Devanna and to Laura Alloway, who's also joined Melbourne City, they are building a little bit of a female Galacticos down there, aren't they? And I think there's probably more to come if the rumours are to be believed.
Yeah, that's a pretty good team already, just on paper. The players that you mentioned, Joe Montemurro is a well-respected coach down there, always puts together good teams. I think, in fact, if my memory serves me correct, he was with the Victory at some point during his coaching career. But yeah, Steph Catley is, you know, scary to say, she's been with Victory for, gosh, I think 7 years before coming over, 6 years, and she's just 21. You know, that's something that's astounding. But, you know, big presence for them. Victory, I think, on the other hand, they're going to have to, you know, replace a lot of key players in that roster to be competitive, because they're a team that are in the top four every season or near just about.
Yeah, very much so. And moving over to Brisbane Roar, we will no doubt see them be packed with internationals from the Australian team. They really underperformed last year. They obviously had Nadine Angerer, who will not be returning this time round, but they have some really interesting players. They have the likes of Claire Polkinghorne and Katrina Gorey and Tamika Butt, and they really do build their side around those Matilda players. And unfortunately for them, didn't quite work out last year, but they are stacked with quality. Tell me, I'm really excited about the W League. Unfortunately, we don't get to see a lot of it. I know that they will be broadcasting games. I think a major broadcaster in Australia has picked them up after the one that's been doing it beforehand dropped them. But there's some really exciting players down there, and I think they are reaping the benefits of yet another good Australian performance in a World Cup. And I think this is a league much like the FAWSL that's growing in popularity and is being able to attract some of the best players.
Out there, and it also helps, you know, they have that unique setup, as does the NWSL, where literally players can not bounce back and forth between the two leagues, but you have your European contingent that are going to stay in Europe for the most part, and you're going to have this North American / Australian contingent that are playing really together and against each other for 9-10 months of the season, whether it's, you know, in the NWSL or in the W League. So, you know, a lot of players are enjoying it. I've talked to plenty of American players who have gone over before and said that it's the perfect league for them, because you come out of the NWSL, you get another 3-4 months of competitive matches, and you're not sitting in that long waiting period. And vice versa for Australian players, that, you know, the W League is short, so having the opportunity to play during the U.S. summer months in the States is, you know, it's great. And you're absolutely right saying that both that the W League now is bringing in a lot of high quality players.
Yeah, absolutely. I didn't even get an opportunity to mention Sydney FC, who have brought in Alana Kennedy and Michelle Batos, who was, of course, the NWSL Goalkeeper of the Year. I mean, that is a real coup for Sydney FC. So I think they're going to be another team that will be looking to try and compete. Historically, they've been one of the stronger teams in the W League. But as I mentioned, really exciting. But it's actually, talking about the W League leads nicely into our interview for this episode. And we mentioned Adelaide United and Sarah Killian going there. And one player who will be continuing and representing the club this year is Melissa Barbieri, Australian goalkeeper, 86 caps, for the Matildas, played in 4 World Cups and an Olympic Games, and she announced her retirement from international football in the last few weeks, and a real great ambassador for Australian football. Hasn't had it easy. We speak about that in the interview, but wanted to have a chat with her. So here she is, having a chat with me about her time playing for the Matildas. So as already mentioned, delighted to be joined by Melissa Barbieri for this episode of Women's Soccer Zone, a number of weeks after she announced her retirement from the Matildas. Melissa, thanks for joining us. First question, I guess I have to jump in with, is why now, and how happy are you with the decision that you've made?
Well, thank you, first of all. This decision wasn't made lightly. I mean, you ponder the decision as you get older as a player, and you're always waiting for that day that you don't enjoy it anymore. And for me, it's not because I don't enjoy it anymore. It's very much more a logistical thing. I want to be at home with my daughter a lot more, and the amount of time that you have to be training as a professional athlete, you have to really devote a lot of time away from your family, because as a footballing nation, you want to come together in camps, and that just means that you have to travel a lot. I'm not lucky that I spend time in areas where they hold a lot of camps, so I'm away for Holly. Especially this year, it was about 6 months of the year that I was away from her, so it's very difficult having a young daughter. And every time I jump on the plane, it was almost like, you know, is it worth it? And now that she kind of understands that I'm leaving, it's really a pull on the heartstrings.
Well, Holly's 2.5 years old, for those that don't know, and I'm sure she was a major influence in your decision. But let's rewind. The purpose of this interview is to have a little bit of a look back at your career with the Matildas. Made your debut, I think it was 2002. But for those that don't know, it's quite interesting because you actually started out as an outfield player and not as a goalkeeper, didn't you?
Yeah, I actually started off as, you know, because I was a left footer. I pretty much made all. Here's Holly, by the way. just to add for effect, yes, this is my daughter if she starts talking. yeah, I played when I was a young child in an all boys team as a field player, and basically grew up wanting to play as a field player in it. And I was the only left footer in a majority of my team, so I made the team quite easily, and I didn't realise I was pretty much a good player until I made the Australian squad as a field outfield when I was 16. And although it was a very testing sort of camp where I went to, it really opened my eyes as to what was necessary to a field player to make the national team. And I love the fact that I didn't make it for a reason, because a couple of years later, I did have an injury that made me, turn up. But like I'd seen all the physios and all the doctors and everything, and I ended up at a surgeon office, and the surgeon basically said, "You're not allowed to play football anymore." And I'm like, "What? That's just ridiculous!" I my heart was broken in that sense, but. I asked the reason, and he was saying that it was because running around made my injury worse. And I was like, well, how about I just stop running around and become a goalkeeper?
So your career was almost over before it even started, which is incredible to think that you've got to where you are now. And it was in 2002, I think it was, that you made your debut as a goalkeeper. It was against Canada, and not only did you win, but you kept a clean sheet as well. Do you remember that game?
I do, like it was yesterday, actually. I'd waited, in terms of waiting a long time to play for Australia, I did. But as a goalkeeper, I rose up the ranks quite quickly. So I became a goalkeeper at the end of 2000. By 2001, I was in the Australian squad, and by 2002, I was playing for Australia. So I was very much at the beginning of my career, just soaking everything up, and I just remembered it wasn't about worrying about the game. So I think I just remember the game wholeheartedly because I was enjoying it so much, and it was a time of learning and experience, and I just made sure that I was soaking everything up as much as possible. I remember a save I made in the dying minutes to keep it at 1-0, and after winning that game, it put me in good stead to play the rest of the tour as number one goalkeeper.
Well, 2003 would have been your first World Cup in the USA after it was had to be postponed from being in China. What do you remember about number one making that squad and how you felt about that, having only been an international goalkeeper for just over a year? And number two, what you remember about being part of that Australian team in that tournament?
I remember feeling amazing that I could go to a World Cup. It was very surreal in the fact that I could say that I'm going to a World Cup. I had only ever heard of men going to World Cup, so it was very much a new sort of adventure. But in terms of notoriety and all that sort of thing, just having that World Cup beside my name was an amazing achievement. And when I got there, I wasn't the number one goalkeeper at the time, but I had the mindset that I wanted to be number one and that I should be number one. And I just kept striving towards that. And then I ended up playing in my first World Cup game in the third match of the group stage. And it was just amazing, the atmosphere, and you just can't beat it. I'd never seen it before. I mean, I'd played in China and those things beforehand, but I didn't ever really, really take notice of the crowd until I went to the World Cup, and it was an amazing feeling.
So you played in Athens in an Olympics in 2004, which I'm sure was a great experience. Played in China in 2007 in your second World Cup, but I'm sure for you one of the highlights had to be 2010 when you captained the Australian team to the Asian Cup, and not only in the Asia Cup, but you went on to win the whole competition as well.
Yes, it was kind of like a blur in that 2010 period where I was made captain. It was very much, I had to pinch myself in the fact that I was being made captain of the Australian team. And I think it was the moment where I called my dad and said, you know, I'm being made captain. And he was like, what? You know, my daughter, captain of the Australian team? It's, you know, and yeah, being able to win so many games as captain and win a major tournament and being responsible and the honour of lifting the trophy at that tournament was amazing. I just, you know, you can't ever describe the exhilaration of being in the game first and foremost. When we beat Japan in the semi-final, which held us through to the World Cup, because those games are very tough in Asia. And when we got to lift the trophy, you kind of just think, you pinch yourself. Not that we ever thought that about the repercussions, that we would be the first Australian team, male or female, to lift silverware. It was very much, we just had our feet firmly grounded and we just got to do the little things. And Tommy, our coach at the time, Tommy Somani, just took the pressure off us and you know, made a joke about it. You know, you're at the World Cup. You've made the World Cup. Whatever you do now, it's just a bonus. Don't worry about it. If you win, you win. If you don't, just go out there and play and have some fun. And so it was all very much, you know, very relaxed. And when we took the silverware home, it kind of dawned on us that we were the first Australian team, and it was just an amazing feeling. And just creating history like that for our country is just amazing.
And it's testament and shows how good that side was, because Japan obviously went on to win the World Cup the following year. How much was that 2010 victory down to the fact that you at this point had a domestic league? The W League launched in 2008-2009, which would have been a year before that Asia Cup tournament took place. How significant was it that you had a domestic league that you were able to play in as a group of individuals and then come together for the Matildas, having had that experience and having had that regular football?
Critical. In fact, many of us wouldn't have had a professional team to train with in between camps. So we were all relying on our own abilities as, you know, personal trainers as well as footballers, because you had to keep yourself motivated daily. And when you've got a domestic league, you can let let go of some of that responsibility and just absorb what you're being taught from coaches. And we had some great caliber coaches in that first couple of years of the W leg. I mean, any team that you went to, you really had a great sense of professionalism. And that's what we all just really lacked in terms of our home lives and our home training sort of senses. When we went into the W leg, we were like, wow, this is amazing. We started to feel like professional footballers, and that puts you into good stead for that mindset of winning things. So when you're treated like a professional and you're able to be a professional, you start acting like a professional, you train like a professional, and your attitude towards winning things becomes fundamental. So when we went into the Asia Cup, by all means, we took every game as it came, because we didn't have that sort of big head notion of that we're going to win things, but we had that work ethic behind us because of that domestic league and our ability to say, okay, we are now professional footballers. We're not just part-timers anymore.
And I believe you won Goalkeeper of the Year in the first W League season as well. So you didn't do too badly, Melissa, when it all kicked off. I mean, when you after the Asia Cup, obviously that would have given a bit of attention on the team back home, I'm sure. The first Australian team, as you say, to pick up some silverware. 2011 was the World Cup in Germany. And in that team were people like yourself and Lisa Devanna, experienced internationals. But then a young crop of individuals started to come through, the likes of Sam Kerr, Caitlin Ford, Emily Van Egmond. You know, these are teenagers that we're talking about. When you looked around at the talent that was in that squad and you looked at how old they were and the potential that was in that squad, at what point was it that you thought, you know what, this is a team that could really go places, and given time and given the opportunity, we could go on to win even more silverware?
It was crazy to think back, or even to look back now at those photos of those kids on the bench. I mean, Caitlin Ford burst onto the scene, and you know, her first game at a World Cup was against Brazil, against Marta, and she absolutely demolished her. I mean, we lost 1-0 in that game, that opening game, but by all means, we won the crowd over with our game and our players. And when I think back to that bright-eyed young Caitlin Ford and Sammy Kerr, you know, they were kids and they had such potential, but they were already amazing players. I mean, Sam Kerr didn't even know what football was. She didn't even know you could go to a World Cup. So it's kind of surreal in the fact that, you know, without, and it's testament to the W League again, like without that W League, these players would never have been recognised. They would never have been looked at as professional players, because, you know, in our Olympic Games in 2004, we had one 16-year-old in Sally Shippard, and she was kind of noticed because she played in Canberra and we kind of had her around the traps anyway. But, you know, 4 years later, you have four young'uns that are capable of playing at a World Cup. So, again, now when I see those players and how much they've grown in the 4 years, not only as footballers but as in and people and knowing what they want. And they've already been through some tough times. Like Sam Kerr has a couple of, you know, quite profound knee injuries and some of the things that they've had to go through and pull through because, you know, there are tough times in football, but they've just grown as people and now they really, really know what they want. And having that certainty in their goals has made them such admirable players. And sometimes I have to pinch myself or stop myself from just watching them from the goal line. I have to remember that I'm in a game and I have to be switched on, because some of the things that they can do is just, it's just awesome.
Yeah, we've raved about them on many a time on this show. The talent that's coming through in Australia is quite remarkable. I was out in Winnipeg for the World Cup and saw your opening game against the US, and you know, started very brightly in that game and were arguably the better team for the first 25 minutes. But I'll come to that in a minute. 2011, as we've mentioned, gave Brazil a very good game. The only game that you lost in your group, you overcame Norway and Equatorial Guinea. Unfortunately, came unstuck in the quarterfinals against Sweden. You then had a break from football for a little while. You became pregnant with Holly not long after that. She was born 2013. it then took you a little bit of time to get back into the game. I was doing my research, and it's essentially said that you couldn't get a club. You're obviously based in Melbourne. You'd been playing for the Melbourne Victory. You'd played for the Matildas, and you couldn't get back into the game. And it was an opportunity in Adelaide that saw you sign with Adelaide United. A friend of yours was the manager, I believe. At the time, how let down did you feel by Australian football, having given so much to the game? You go away, you have a child, and then when you want to come back and do what you love and do what is essentially your job, you're kind of prevented from doing that.
It was one of those times where in the transition period between coaches, from national team coaches, so from Tommy to the new coach, it was very much based on that person's view of someone returning to football from pregnancy. And I don't want to label the entire footballing, the Football Federation or anything. I just felt let down by, because that coach was female, I was let down by, you know, another female. Like, I felt that I wasn't being backed. And I understand that each coach wants to look at things new and they don't want to bring into the past, but I thought I deserved a little bit more respect than I was given. And you know, that might have been a bit of my ego talking at the time, but I thought that what I'd done in the game, I thought at least I deserved some sort of opportunity to show what I was made of and that I should have been backed. And I'm sure if our previous coach had continued on, he would have looked after us, the women that had gotten pregnant, because there was another person at the time, Heather. And I'm sure if he had continued in that role, it might have looked after us a little bit better, made sure we had more support going through it. But it was when I was cut from all scholarships, so it wasn't even just the Australian football, it was my home state and my institute, and all my funding kind of went out the window just because I had a baby. And I'm sure a lot of women are out there and in every sort of professional position that they hold, they will find some sort of discrimination because of being a mother, because they have kids and because they have differing sort of, roles. And that splits their time, so they are regarded as less of a person in that role. And that was the hardest part for me, that somebody could think that just because I had a baby that I was no longer an elite athlete, when in essence I came back stronger, I felt better. And when I was labelled, probably the toughest thing for me was when I was labelled somebody that was tough to work with. That was the hardest part for me, because all I ever wanted to do was to do what was best for football, because I stuck my neck out for a lot of players and things in terms of, you know, being a captain and being the voice for a lot of people. I was labelled then a troublemaker. So sometimes when you get labelled a troublemaker, you find it hard to find a club as well. So when I had Adelaide give me a lifeline with Ross Aloisi, he knew me as a, we weren't friends at the time, we were just, we had just gone to the same conference and, you know, been at a coaching license together. So he knew my drive to make the national team because we had a conversation. And then it just ultimately meant that when he was given the position, he thought of me straight away when they mentioned that I'd asked. So that was an incredible leap of faith on his behalf. But he could see the in my mind that I wanted to become a national team player again, and he knew that overrode everything that had happened to me in the past.
We had to be patient. You obviously took your opportunity at Adelaide, and you came back into the game not long after Holly was born. You have a couple of seasons playing for Adelaide and playing well in the W League, and then you get called up into the World Cup squad for the Matildas in Canada. Number one, when you were called up to the squad, what was your reaction, having had to wait so long and to be patient? And number two, when you found out you were starting that opening game in Winnipeg, what was your reaction?
Firstly, the call up was sort of bittersweet because, you know, it meant that people that I respected and, you know, I loved, that were my friends and my teammates, didn't make the team. So I was shattered that they weren't coming with us, and elated at the same time that all my hard work and persistence had paid off. Because there were many times where I thought, why don't I just retire? Like, why am I doing this? I'm not getting any time. I'm not getting called up to any internationals. I mean,
why didn't you retire?
Why didn't I? I couldn't go out like that. I couldn't go out not having giving it my complete and utter dedication. If I had have given up, you know, a month or two earlier, I wouldn't have been able to say I did it everything that I could. Whereas if I put it all through, I put everything on the line and I waited for that, no, you're not going to the World Cup, I knew that I'd actually performed to the best of my ability. And if my selection was out of my hands, I did what I could in terms of playing the best that I could. And that at the end of the day had to rest well with me when I finished my career. So if I had given up a month earlier, it would have been, I wouldn't have been able to say that. I would have had to, you know, swallow that sort of bitter pill of I didn't quite get to the end. And I'm sure glad I didn't retire. I didn't give up when it was tough. I just pushed. I pushed through that one last that final battle. And when I got the call up, it was for that first game. It was a massive surprise because I was not going as number one goalkeeper, and I was there for my ability to back up Lydia as the number one goalkeeper. And I was proud of the fact that they chose me to be entrusted with the position while Lydia was mending her leg. So I was incredibly honoured to be chosen. And then that feeling of walking out in front of that crowd, but also with my teammates and knowing that it's probably going to be my last game for Australia, was such a goosebump moment. I'm not sure if anyone saw me in the lineup or belting out the national anthem, but that's how much it meant to me. That's how much playing for Australia meant for me. And it was kind of tough because I knew Lydia would be playing the next game. No problems about that. And when I belted out that national anthem, I soaked it all up. And then when I played the game, it was like that addiction gets given back to you. You know, when you're trying to give chocolate up and someone just gives you a slither of Cadbury's chocolate and you're like, what the hell? And you're back on the wagon. So when I got that call up and I played that first game, it was like that passion just reignited again, and you're kind of like, oh, should I retire? And all these questions start running through your mind again. But it was an absolute honour to take the field with those girls. It was truly an inspiration while I was playing with them and when I was sitting on the bench for the other matches too.
We mentioned how much potential is in that squad and how well you've done in the 2015 tournament. I know you're retired now, so you're probably not privy to a lot of the conversations that are going on, but while I've got you, I just wanted to get your views on the kind of the dispute that's going on between the players and the FFA. And obviously they made the decision to pull out of a recent tour to the United States to go and play the World Cup champions. I just wondered what your views were on what the situation is at the moment, because we know that these women have put in good performances in the last few tournaments and clearly don't feel that they are being rewarded with what they feel they're worth.
When you play for your country as a female athlete, you do it solely because of pride and what it brings to you in terms of playing with your friends and, and that sense of camaraderie and all those things. But when you have to ply your trade every day away from home, you can't hold down a job, it's very difficult to do that to the best of your ability. So as athletes, we need to be able just to fend for ourselves in terms of paying for food, paying for rent. I have a mortgage that I have to cover alongside my husband. I'm very lucky that I have a partner that is very supportive and stays at home while I'm out gallivanting, playing, chasing a leather ball around. So not everybody has that sort of partnership. A lot of women at 25 are still living at home with their parents. And a lot of their friends have completed university degrees, have now got careers and are fully funding themselves. They've got new cars. And when you play for your country and you're told that you're famous, yet that you come home and you have to find a job where you wait tables and you have to slog it out just to make ends meet when you're not getting paid because of a CBA disagreement, all those emotions sort of build up and you kind of think, you know, what am I worth? Am I being paid what I'm worth? Do they support me? And we understand that it's a whole of game agreement this time. So the men, A-League, the Socceroos and the Matildas are all combined into one. So we're all fighting for the same things. But in terms of ourselves, we couldn't bear to, you know, go to play for our country when we haven't been paid for 2 months. And that's like what they wanted to pay us was great in terms of that then and there. But what happens in the long run? It's okay for the people that got selected for that tour, but what about the people that didn't get selected? You know, that they have to train at an elite level every day, every day, every day, and then not get paid. That means that they're not getting that remuneration for all the work that they've done, yet still are required to do all that work. It just didn't make sense. So we know as footballers that we have to train a lot more. We have to do a lot more than we did in the past to keep up with your USA, your Germany, your Japan, your England, your France. So when you don't have that in-club sort of professionalism like just say, for example, Germany does, where they go for an entire year where they're training every day, twice a day, sometimes three times a day. And how are we supposed to keep up with that when we have to do work, earn money, and go to training all at the same time? It's too much of a burden on us as people, as human beings, to have to do that. I mean, if we just got paid that little bit extra, we could just wholeheartedly devote our lives to what we love to do. And I mean, we'd still do the university degrees and all those sorts of things, but you know, we wouldn't have to have that burden of, oh, I can't pay the bills this month, or I have to move all my stuff into storage and let go of my rental property because I can't afford rent while I'm away.
I think Holly agrees with you, clearly.
It's all added effect, isn't it?
Absolutely. It makes it more authentic. You won't hear me complaining. I mean, I remember I interviewed Katrina Gori earlier this year, and she was obviously named Asian Footballer of the Year, and she was telling me that she works in a cafe, like you said, waiting tables during the day and then trains in the evening, which seems absolutely ridiculous. But I appreciate you giving an honest assessment on that one. So we've talked about your Australia career, 86 caps, 4 World Cups and Olympic Games, tremendous, tremendous ambassador for Australian football. You picked up a nice little award recently, didn't you? The Football Federation Victoria Hall of Fame, I believe you were entered into. So I'm sure it's a nice little kind of accolade to come back home to tie in with that as well.
Yeah, I mean, it was an extreme surprise. First and foremost, I didn't know that I was being inducted into the Hall of Fame, and the sense of pride you feel as a Victorian. You know, I was the lone Victorian in the Australian team for a long time, and it's great that I have impacted Victorian women's football in a way that you know, people think, let's acknowledge that with a Hall of Fame. So as I quietly went about my business, it was nice that people were watching and seeing what I was doing and gave me such a tremendous honour in inducting me. But what I'm excited for is the next generation of Victorian players coming through. And I mean, I wholeheartedly pass the baton on to, you know, Steph Catley and Breanna Davey and those sorts of players coming through the ranks. And it's just a tremendous honour that I could be a Victorian in the Australian team for so long.
Well, it's been a genuine pleasure to look back what's been a remarkable career. As I mentioned, many accolades, Asian Cup winner, World Cups, Olympic Games. It's been a really great career and as I mentioned, a great ambassador for Australian football. I'm sure that you will continue to be in the W League, and I'm certain that when you do retire altogether, you will no doubt keep your toe dipped in the football pond. But Minister, it's been a genuine pleasure. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Kieran.
Women's Soccer Zone. Listen to the show on Audioboom or download via iTunes. Just search for Women's Soccer Zone.
So that was Melissa Barbieri. Big thanks to her for appearing on the show, someone that we've wanted to get on for a little while. And I think, JJ, that brings us to the end of this show. Lots to pack in. Apologies if we've missed anything off that was deemed important to listeners. I can assure you it wasn't deliberate, but it's very difficult to try and pack things into an hour show. But if you want to contact us and give us any feedback on any suggestions, if you think we've missed anything, let us know. On Twitter, on @WosoZone. You can contact us via email on wosozone@gmail.com. And don't forget, the show is available on iTunes. Just search for Women's Soccer Zone or listen to us on audioboom.com/WosoZone. Quick one from me. Very big thanks to any listeners who came to our She Kicks Back live event in London a couple of weeks ago. Kelly Smith and former England goalkeeper Pauline Cope, or Pauline Bonus, as many will know her now, doing a great job for us, a live event with an audience and a Q&A. Pleased to say that anyone who was at that event or anyone that listens and is interested in events that might be happening in the future, we do plan to do more. Currently planning the next one at the moment, so look out for an announcement within the next few weeks. But JJ, I think that's it, mate. Thanks very much, as always, for coming on board.
Yeah, no problem. And a quick one for me. Do have to give a shout out. We don't ever talk about the Danish league, but Chichi Igbo made her 250th appearance for Fortuna Hjørring this past week. So congratulations to her. She's been with that club forever, and it's great to see that she got awarded that.
Yeah, and interestingly that you mentioned Denmark there. I think Pernille Harder recently became the all-time leading scorer for Linköping in the Damallsvenskan. So she is a player who is on fire at the moment, and it wouldn't be surprising if she is attracting some interest from other clubs. But as I said, thank you very much for tuning in, and we will speak to you all very, very soon.